This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
And welcome to the show. I'm Chua Untik. Susan Carlin is an Australian Muslim who has been at various stages of her career, a radio correspondent, a television presenter, a newspaper columnist, as well as a sociology lecturer at Monash University in Australia, where she is currently pursuing a PhD on the intersection of gender and culture in Islam. In 2009, Susan was named one of the 500 most influential Muslims in the world by the United Nations Alliance of Civilizations. Pleased to have her in the studio with us to talk about her academic interests as well as the Australian experience when it comes to women, gender and Islam. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Susan, you discovered Islam at age 17 and converted at 19. What made you want to advocate, comment and write publicly about Islam?
I'm not sure, really, to be honest. I guess what I feel passionately on the inside just naturally manifests itself in my external actions. And so when I saw that the way Muslims were being spoken about in the mainstream media in Australia wasn't something that I felt was accurate or fair, I wanted to participate in the conversation. I thought you can't just sit outside the conversation and complain about it. You need to participate as well and join in. And so I did.
Did you feel qualified to talk about it? How was the process?
No, not qualified at all. I think my only qualification was the fact that I was a practicing Muslim woman and I existed within the Muslim community. And so when people would get on the radio or TV and say, all Muslim women are this, or this is what Islam teaches about Muslim women or the treatment of non-Muslims, I felt qualified enough to say, sorry, that's not true. I know enough to know that's not right. And so I felt that I could certainly contribute to the conversation in a beneficial way.
To say your mother objected to your conversion would be an understatement. Tell us about your coming out process, so to speak.
Well, I think I was quite nervous about telling my family that I was that I decided to become Muslim. And actually what happened was I became Muslim when I was 19. My parents had gone away for a few days. And I was so nervous to tell them when they came back. I thought, oh, no, I'm too scared. I'm not going to tell them. And then my mum decided to cook pork chops for dinner that night. And so that my hand was forced. And so I had to tell her, look, I've decided to become Muslim. And she cried and she hugged me. But it was very hard. And it was the start of a difficult time, specifically between my mum and I. But, you know, it's been 16 years now and a lot of water has gone under the bridge and we've got a fantastic relationship now. She buys myself and my husband and my children gifts for Eid. She buys me headscarves as presents. She rings to check how I'm going with fasting. And we, you know, equally try to be respectful and accommodating of, you know, her holidays and things like that. I want to teach my children that we can't expect her to acknowledge Eid and Ramadan if we don't acknowledge Christmas for her, for example. So we got a really great relationship now.
Based on your interaction in a community, how does the experience of a convert differ from those born into the religion?
I think it's interesting. Converts are sort of met with a sort of delight and enthusiasm. People are really excited and they always want to know, you know, why did you decide to become Muslim? And, you know, tell us your conversion story. I'm asked to tell a million times. So there's that sort of positivity, but there's also sort of the belief often comes out that we, no matter how long we've been Muslim or how much we've learned, we don't really ever know as much as a true born Muslim. So we're always converts, you know. And so, you know, it doesn't matter how long I've been Muslim. You know, I've been Muslim for, 16 years now. But people will still want to tell me that, did you know that Islam is built on five pillars? You know, and I'm like, actually, yes, I didn't know that. I've known that for quite some time. So we're kind of viewed as almost like pets, I think, in that we're cute and we're interesting and people like to know about our conversion stories, but we're always or generally often seen as, you know, not as ever as informed or as religious as born Muslims.
Being a non-Arab convert add to the complexity or nature of the problem?
I think so. I mean, in Australia, not so much because, you know, the Muslim community is so relatively small anyway. There's less than 500,000 Muslims in all of Australia. But, you know, when I've travelled throughout the Muslim world, you know, Muslims often are quite sort of confused by me. They're like, why is this white woman wearing a headscarf? It just doesn't connect in their minds. You know, when culture is so closely tied to religion, in a lot of countries. They can't, well, you're white, so you must be Christian. You know, I'm Arab, so I'm Muslim. And so it really seems to baffle people. Often they won't want to let me into the mosque to pray because they don't believe I'm Muslim. So, there's definitely the cultural element definitely plays a role.
Is it difficult being a Muslim in Australia today?
It's not as difficult as people think, I think, would be the first thing I'd want to say. You know, it's not like every time I step out of the front door, I'm spat at and have eggs thrown at me or anything like that. You know, by and large, life is pretty easy and normal. You know, we go about our daily lives. I feel very confident and happy raising my children as Muslims in Australia. And one of the reasons for that is we actually have a lot of religious freedom in Australia. The government, so long as we obey the laws, the government doesn't really care how we practice Islam. So we have a lot of freedom and autonomy to find our own way of interpreting Islam and how we want to practice. So that's really nice. There's no sort of government interference in the way we do Islam, quote unquote. Certainly there are instances of discrimination, like in every society. There can be instances of discrimination against Muslims. But what's also heartening for me is the way the Australian community often responds to that. So while there'll always be a vocal minority that says that they hate Muslims and that they don't want us here and they don't want us dressing the way that we do, often you'll find a larger group of non-Muslims will come out in defence of us in public and say, you shouldn't say that, don't speak like that, you know, and they'll affirm our place in Australia. So it's not perfect, but it's I have a lot of hope for the way the country runs.
I'll come back to religious freedom later in the discussion, but the reason I asked that question is because you spoke of the scrutiny and the suspicion that the Muslim communities all over Australia face in the aftermath of 9/11, right up to the London bombings. What was your reaction to the rise of global terrorism and its constant linkage to Islam?
I mean, obviously, you know, as a human being, I feel upset at the rise of global terrorism. I think everybody feels upset at the innocent lives being, you know, lost so pointlessly and randomly. But then, you know, I guess the next level is this, the real frustration as a Muslim, you know, living in a country like Australia, where, as I said, we are such a minority. You know, there's less than 2% of Australia are Muslim. So a really small group. And, you know, something terrible would happen overseas, the Bali bombing or the London bombing or whatever. And I would then have to go out on the street in my hijab and have people look at me thinking that I supported those actions. That was really awful. And I hated that. I hated people just assuming that that's what I believed. But, you know, when you do live in a country where there aren't a lot of Muslims, the only source of information a country like Australia, you know, the population of Australia really has about Islam is what they see in the media. And so I can sort of understand why they would think that, because if they're not getting any alternative perspectives, then why would they think anything different? Which was one of the motivations for, you know, a lot of the activities and initiatives I participate in, like TV shows and museum exhibits and stuff like that, because I think you have to give people an alternative way of understanding. People need to take responsibility for themselves as well and sort of question what they believe and what they take on. But also we need to take, as Muslims, need to take a responsibility to make sure alternative modes of understanding what it means to be a Muslim are available to people.
Was the media fair, you think, in covering all those events?
I'm not someone who believes there's this global conspiracy against Muslims. I don't think that, you know, by and large, the media is out to get us. And I say that because I know, you know, I've had experiences with journalists in Australia who I know have gone out of their way to find the good news story or to present light and shade to an issue. So I don't believe the entire media is out to get us. That being said, I do think there are some networks or stations or publications that are more alarmist than others and do present things in, you know, just idiotic McDonald's type journalism ways that I think are totally unhelpful. I don't think everything is a media conspiracy against Muslims. I just don't believe that.
You talk about how you had to take hands into your own matters and go on the TV and radio to talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
Was it a community-wide burden or responsibility that they have to shoulder in order to present the best face of themselves forward all the time?
Yeah, I think, yeah, definitely there is that sense that, you know, when you are a small minority and you're a visible minority, like as a Muslim woman who wears the headscarf, yeah, there is this opinion or this sense that everything you do is being viewed through the prism of, well, that's because you're Muslim. So if my husband and I are walking on the street, you know, and he happens to walk a few steps ahead of me because I'm window shopping, people think, well, look, he's walking ahead because he's the man, and that's because he's superior and she has to walk behind. You know, everything is given this meaning when none necessarily exists. So that can be really tiresome when you're constantly in Dawa mode. You're constantly in this mode of having to try to reassure people that you're just a human being, you know, that this is just like you. We have good and bad and good days and bad days and whatever. But in terms of, you know, the TV and stuff like that, I really felt that as a Muslim, if you're not at the table for discussion, then you're on the menu. Again, it's a matter of we can sit back and complain or we can try to change things. And so, like, the TV show I was part of was the first time that not only were Muslims part of the sitting at the table, but we were serving up the meal as well. And we were telling people, we're going to decide how this conversation goes. This little tiny half-hour show is the one opportunity a week that we get to decide how Muslims are presented in the media.
Picking up, that's good, but people from within your community might not like what you have to say as well and don't agree with how you're representing their religion. How do you deal with internal criticism?
Absolutely. That's always really difficult. I think in the end, one of the things I've learned from the things I've done and, you know, the criticism that I've received is you can't ever keep everybody happy. No matter what you do, there will be people who criticize you and they don't like the way that you do things. Even if you stay at home and do nothing, there will be people who criticize you for that. And so what I realized is that I need to have people in my life whose opinion I really trust and who I really look up to and respect. And they will be the people that I go to for advice and say to them, do you think I did the wrong thing in this situation when I said this? Was it wrong? Did I handle it wrong? And really take on board what they say. And because there's a cacophony of voices out there telling you that you're great and that you're terrible and that you're amazing and that you're awful, and it can be impossible, it can be totally debilitating to know what's the right thing to do. And so you really need to know for yourself, what do I really think is right here? What's the greater goal that I'm trying to achieve? And have those few voices that you really trust and respect, and then just keep pushing on, because there will always be detractors and critics. You know, and as a Muslim, we believe ultimately I'm going to have to stand before God and answer to God. So do I feel comfortable with that? Then do the people that I respect and look up to say that I'm doing a good thing? And then you just keep pushing on.
I have been speaking to Susan Carlin from the School of Political and Social Inquiry at Monash University in Australia. Coming up, we'll get her thought on what multiculturalism is and as well as whether she agrees with the burqa ban in France. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. On the show today is Susan Carlin. She is from the School of Political and Social Inquiry at Monash University in Australia. And we are talking about religion, multiculturalism, and what it means to be a Muslim in Australia. Susan, what's your thought on France's burqa ban?
I'm not a big fan of it, I have to say. And I think that's because I always feel uncomfortable with societies dictating how people, especially women, dress. So I feel just as uncomfortable about you know, countries where women are forced to cover, like Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia, but also countries like France or up until relatively recently, Turkey, women weren't allowed to wear headscarves and go to university. Anytime where women's freedoms about how they dress is taken away from them and, you know, enforced by the state, I feel uneasy about. And especially in France, I think it's just incredibly short-sighted. You know, such a small percentage of women in France wear the niqab or the burqa and cover their face. It's really going to alienate a small group of people who already feel quite vulnerable in the society, who probably already feel like they're not made to feel welcome in France, that they don't belong. And so doing something like that, and similarly the headscarf ban in France, you know, girls aren't allowed to wear headscarves to school, to public schools. I think doing something like that is so short-sighted, because I think what it will do is make the community, the Muslim community, withdraw in on itself even more and feel more victimized and more alienated and less part of, you know, mainstream cohesive French society, which can only cause more problems. I'm really not a fan of it at all, especially a country like France that likes to talk about how it's based on things like liberty and brotherhood. I think it's really counterintuitive, and I can't see it solving any problems at all.
But it is their strand of secularism, isn't it? Because where in order to include everyone, they have to keep religion out of public life so that religion becomes exclusively in the domain of people's private lives. Mm. Don't you agree with that, that religion should be kept out of public lives, from town halls, from schools, public buildings?
I don't like the way the premise is framed, because I think secularism isn't the absence of religion from the public domain. It's the non-privileging of religion from the public domain. And it's that you can't push religious beliefs or freedoms, religious beliefs in a public area, but it's not the total absence of them. It's the open marketplace of ideas really is secularism. So there should be nothing anti-secular about a woman wearing a headscarf, a Jewish man wearing a yarmulke, or a Christian wearing a cross in public society, in a secular society. It's when it's enforced on other people that becomes anti-secular. And so forcing the removal of religious symbols, to me, seems counterintuitive. It's about not privileging religious beliefs above any others, which, you know, if that's what a secular society wants to do, then, you know, that's their society, they can do what they want. But when freedoms are impinged upon, especially for no real benefit, because it's one thing to argue that we need to ban the burqa because we have problems with identification and those sort of things. Okay, I might think that there are flaws in the argument, but I can see where you're coming from. But banning something like the headscarf, there's no functional purpose to that. Wearing a headscarf, for example, or a Jewish man wearing a yarmulke, in no way prohibits social cohesion or social interaction. So to me, it seems really myopic and short-sighted that they would do something like that and not think it could only have negative repercussions. I think if anything, it's just going to make the Muslim community withdraw more into itself, which can then only create further tensions.
Mm-hmm. How is this issue playing out in Australia? You guys flirted with the idea of burning a burqa.
Every now and then it comes up. It's always a surprise when it comes up, because nothing seems to have sparked it. It just seems to be every now and then a politician raises it as something that they want to do. And it's interesting because I remember the last time it was proposed by a certain politician, and he was saying, you know, in the interest of security, we need to be able to see women's faces and those sort of things. But interestingly, none of the banks had said, we want women to uncover their faces when they come into the banks. We don't see it as a security issue. The post office hadn't seen it as an issue. The police weren't calling for it. So who actually is calling for this for security reasons? You know, it really felt like that was an instance of a politician trying to drum up fear for no reason whatsoever. It's not like we just suddenly had all these women in niqabs go and rob banks. And then, you know, you could understand having a social conversation then. So when none of the security agencies or banks or anything like that were calling for it, we have to legitimately ask, well, where is this coming from? What's the real purpose behind this? And, you know, the proposed ban, you know, fortunately went nowhere. And again, because in a country like Australia, very few women wear it. So to create a law about something like this on an issue that really hasn't created any problems seems, you know, a bit alarming.
Tell us more about Australia's policy on multiculturalism and how it has strived to include all its various ethnic minorities.
Yeah, I mean, I think Australia, by and large, now call itself pretty proudly multicultural. We are an incredibly multicultural country. You know, people come from, you know, more than 100 different cultural backgrounds or something. So we are really multicultural, and especially Melbourne, where I'm from, is probably the most successfully multicultural city in Australia. Certainly, it's not a country without its issues. Every now and then discrimination will come up, or we'll see, you know, instances of racism in the public sphere that are worrying and upsetting. But I guess the thing that is reassuring for me is that those instances always create pretty vigorous social conversation about, well, what's going on in Australia? What does this mean for Australia? How can we stop this from happening again? That we also have laws that prohibit religious and racial vilification. We have laws that protect, you know, for example, no one is allowed to tell me that they won't hire me because I wear a headscarf. That's against the law in Australia. So we have laws to protect those sort of things as well, and religious freedom. It's not a perfect society. No society is perfect, but it's actually, by and large, I think, you know, it handles things decently.
There are significant pushbacks, though, most notably in John Howard's, your previous Prime Minister, One Australia policy. Is multiculturalism a concept that is sufficiently understood?
I think that's a really good question. I think I wonder how successful Australia's multiculturalism will be until we can really come to grips with the treatment of Indigenous people in Australia. Treatment of Indigenous Australians, you know, pretty unarguably is not great. They have a much lower life expectancy. Things are not good for Indigenous Australians. We can't pretend otherwise. And I wonder until we, Australia as a nation, can really address that issue in a, you know, dignified and holistic way, if we will continue to have issues with other areas of multiculturalism. I think it's getting better every year in terms of, you know, our general multicultural policy. But, you know, we still have instances where we see racial abuse on buses and things like that, that shows it certainly hasn't been eradicated, and we need to be really vigilant about making sure that as a society we take it really seriously.
UK Prime Minister David Cameron famously or infamously said in 2011 that state multiculturalism has failed. Where do you think Britain went wrong?
That's a big question. Where did they go wrong? I don't know. I don't know if they did go wrong.
I guess the question is, how can community live together without losing their cultural identity, right?
I think that's the thing, is that I think we need to move beyond conversations of tolerance. I think this idea that we need to tolerate each other is really problematic, because tolerate basically means I'm just going to put up with you. I'll endure you. You know, I tolerate a headache. We need to really come from a place of genuinely respecting each other and accepting that because you might do things differently in your own cultural community, that that doesn't necessarily threaten the social cohesion of the wider community. So it's about every society finding that balance between immigrant and migrant communities maintaining cultural practices and language and those sort of things, while at the same time still feeling entirely part of the wider community and contributing to the wider community to make it feel good and better. How we do that as a society, I'm not entirely sure. The way I manage it the best I can is with my own children and really trying to expose them to a lot of different beliefs and cultural backgrounds and teaching them things about the way that we treat other people, that you can't keep demanding people respect and understand you if you're not going to give it back. And so I really go out of my way to try to expose them to a lot of different cultural and religious practices and beliefs, because I think it's good for them. And what's been one of the most pleasantly surprising parts of it is that the more I've exposed them to different cultural practices and different religious practices of other people, the more affirming it has been for my own children as their Australian Muslim identity. So people, when I tell them, you know, we're going to this or we're doing that, they're like, oh, but don't you worry that it might negatively affect their beliefs. If anything, it's really reaffirmed them, because they can see, okay, that's what they do. This is who I am. When everybody is different, nobody is different. And it's a way for them to feel confident in themselves without being arrogant. And I think that's the tension that we all need to try to engage.
What about religious schools? Do they have a place in multicultural societies?
I think they do. I don't have a problem with them at all. I don't send my children to religious schools during the week. They just go to, you know, just everyday non-Muslim schools in Australia. But I don't have a problem with them at all. I think that, you know, religious communities need to feel that they can impart religious values the way that they see is fit and appropriate for them. And so long as they are not teaching or doing anything that contradicts wider societal laws, I don't think there's a problem with it at all. And again, I think actually prohibiting them, again, would only cause more problems and make people withdraw into themselves.
Do you think democracy is compatible with Islam?
Oh, yeah, I do. I do. I don't have a problem with it at all. Islamic scholarship is a very wide and very deep ocean, and it is unfortunate to me that you know, the Muslim community at times can seem to take a quite a simplistic view about what our religion does and doesn't allow and what our religious tradition teaches. And I think if you go, you know, into classical Islamic scholarship, the scope of what is seen as permissible and worth engaging with is much, much broader than a lot of Muslims realise. I don't think democracy is anything necessarily to be feared at all religiously.
Well, if we flip the question around, do you think, can representative government flourish in an Islamic state?
Ah, that's a very good question. These are great questions. I think there is no theoretical reason why they can't or shouldn't. I think ideally the Islamic idea would be that they should be able to be representative and represent the people. And, you know, this idea that Islamic government can only ever be authoritarian or a dictatorship is the antithesis of Islam. You know, if we look at the earliest days of Islam when we had our leaders, the leaders would say to the people, you know, if you see me doing the wrong thing, I want you to pull me up and correct me. That's the kind of leadership, you know, the ideal Muslim leader would be, when the average person on the street could say to them, what you're doing is wrong. This is why it's wrong and you shouldn't be doing it. And the leader would listen, as opposed to curtailing freedom of speech and no, you can't criticize me or anything like that. You know, a true and good Muslim leader would want to be criticized by their people, because if it's done in good faith and with, you know, a good heart, we should all want each other to, we should want to be correcting each other for the greater good.
Tell us about your academic interest and how you approach Islamic scholarship.
Well, I mean, my academic interest in terms of my PhD, which I've been doing for the past 500 years, I'm looking specifically at the way Muslim women fight sexism within the Muslim community. So I'm interviewing I've interviewed in Australia and overseas Muslim female theologians and activists and writers and bloggers, talking to them about the different way that they fight sexism within the Muslim community. And what's been most interesting is that all except one are really passionate, committed Muslim women who say they use the religion to achieve what they want to achieve, far from seeing Islam as, you know, prohibitive of women's rights or getting in the way of them achieving their goals. They say things cannot change without Islam. Islam is the only thing that will create lasting change for Muslim women in the Muslim community. So it's been really exciting and validating to talk to these women and see what they're doing. And I guess in terms of my approach to Islamic scholarship, that's just a continuation of that. Like I said, you know, Islamic scholarship is this big, rich, deep ocean. And when you start to look into it and you see the myriad different opinions that have always existed within Islam, without censure, that, you know, there was always scholars debating quite vociferously with each other about every issue under the sun, and the opinions that existed traditionally that if someone had now, people would just be aghast and say, how could you have it? I think, you know, our scholarship is actually really drying up and becoming far less rich than it used to be. So the more I study Islamic scholarship, the more amazed and excited I am.
Well, speaking of sexism, how did this tradition or interpretation of modern modest dressing arise?
It's interesting. I think the vast majority of Muslim scholars, classically and in modern times, would state that a Muslim woman should, a Muslim woman and a Muslim man should dress modestly, and certain parts of the body should be covered. Now, obviously, that's taken on cultural interpretations around the world, and you can see that the way a Muslim woman in Turkey dresses is very different to the way a Somali Muslim woman dresses, which is very different to the way an Indonesian Muslim woman dresses. There are cultural manifestations of that. There is certainly a very small minority opinion that says men and women should dress modestly, but women don't have to cover their hair. That's more of a cultural manifestation. But really, the majority opinion, the vast majority opinion, is that women covering their hair, men having a beard, is something that is, if not religiously required, covering the hair is religiously required for women, and growing a beard is strongly recommended for men. That being said, how that manifests takes very different forms, not only in different cultures, but in different times. You know, the way I'm dressed now is obviously not how women 1400 years ago would have been dressed in a denim jacket with green earrings. But that's okay. There actually isn't, it doesn't have to be just this one size fits all. And that, again, that comes back to Islamic scholarship, is that the rules generally in most things are pretty broad, and then they fit the culture and the time in which it manifests. But that being said, obviously, you know, I wear a headscarf. I believe it's something that I should do religiously. But I know that, you know, I've got female friends out there that don't cover their hair, and they believe religiously what they're doing is right as well. And, you know, I'm not in a position to judge them.
How you define then what is feminism, and are you a feminist?
Feminism is, you know, it's a very contested term. But I think, you know, and there's been volumes and volumes written on it in academia about what does feminism mean. But I think, you know, some of the most concise definitions are often the best, which is that feminism is the radical notion that a woman is a human being. And that's actually pretty on the money. I understand that a lot of Muslims have issue with, and you know, not just Muslims, but non-Muslims as well, have issue with the term feminism, especially if they come from non-Western countries, because feminism was often seen as part of a colonizing force. You know, it was when Western countries came in and invaded countries, other countries, they brought feminism and different rights for women in with them. So it can be seen quite negatively in that light. You know, I guess I consider myself a feminist in as much that I believe that women have a right to equality and dignity and respect, as men do. To be honest, the term feminism, whether I consider myself a feminist or not, is actually really immaterial to me. I'm much more interested in pragmatics, which is how are we changing things to be better for society, for women, which also makes things better for men. Mm-hmm. It's better for men to live in a society where women have more rights as well and are treated as equal. So I'm more interested in the pragmatic on the ground thing. If believing those things about women makes me a feminist, then so be it. If it doesn't, then so be it. I actually don't worry so much about the label as about the work being done.
Coming back to Australia, Australian politician Cory Bernardi often speaks out against Islamism in defence of Australian values. What are Australian values? Does it exist?
That is the million-dollar question. That's what everybody likes to go on about. And we talk a lot in Australia about, well, what are our values? You know, anytime anyone suggests anything, it's very easy to say, well, a lot of other countries have those values. What's uniquely Australian about that? And because there's sort of, I don't know if it's an identity crisis in Australia, but a lack of clear-cut certainty about what makes us Australian, that's why I think it's easy for someone like Cory Bernardi to perhaps come out and say things like, well, this is un-Australian, Muslims are un-Australian, or whatever it was that he exactly said. And because there's sort of this diffuse, nebulous idea about what it means to be Australian, people can say, oh, well, maybe that's right. You know, the reality is Australia is a multicultural country. Muslims were in Australia before white settlement. So how un-Australian are we? We came before the First Fleet. So we've existed since before white people came. We've always been part of the Australian experience. Muslims in Australia aren't, in addition to the mainstream Australian experience, we are part of the mainstream Australian experience, and we contribute as much to Australian society as anybody else. And so I think comments like Cory Bernardi's are unfortunate and unhelpful, but again, it's reassuring to me that he's definitely in the minority, and even people within his own political party think that that was just an unnecessary thing to say.
Do you think race and religion is a factor in Australia's resistance to a more permissive immigration policy?
I definitely think it could play a role. You know, studies have shown that the fears that people have of immigration in Australia often simply aren't based on fact. And when they're presented with the actual facts about number of immigrants, where immigrants are coming from, their fears fell dramatically. So I think it's very easy to whip up hysteria and alarm with a lack of proper information for people, and to sort of present things like there's this, you know, this flood of immigrants coming from alarming countries and we don't know anything about them, when that's simply not true. And I think when people are presented with the reality, their opinions change. And I think it's also important for us as Australians to keep in mind our international obligations to help refugees and asylum seekers.
A final question. You come from a country that allows freedom of expression and religion, a privilege that many Muslims and women around the world don't have. What is your advice to them, and what can they do in issues like apostasy, in terrorism, in this pursuit to dampen hardliners, extremism, radicalism, even problems that Malaysia faces, homegrown jihadists going abroad to fight under the umbrella of ISIS or ISIL?
So what advice would I give them with freedom of expression?
Yeah.
It's a tough one, because, I mean, any advice I give them is easy for me to say when I live in a country that protects my rights to say it. I don't know what advice I could give them. All I can say is that I'm very glad that I live in a country with freedom of expression. What I see happening in countries where there isn't freedom of expression, where, you know, in Egypt, for example, journalists were arrested and put in prison simply for reporting the news. They weren't making things up. That terrifies me and alarms me and upsets me, and I wish that that would happen much, much less, and personally saddens me all the more when I see it happening in so-called Muslim countries, because when I see them trying to use their religion to justify that behaviour, it just makes me sick.
What is it that in this moment in time particularly that one religion is seemingly so much more responsible for violence than other religions?
I'm not sure that that is the case. I think that it can be presented that way. But, you know, studies have shown when, you know, this idea that not all Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslim, that standard line that gets thrown around. People have gone and done studies and found that that's simply not the case. Not even a majority of terrorists are Muslims. You know, a lot of pretty scary terrorism happens around the world by people that aren't Muslim and have no claim to Islam at all. But I think, you know, especially when we live in countries where such events have relevancy to us, it's going to be more prominent in our public conversation and the media's imagination. And so it will seem more like that is the case and then it isn't. But also I think it's worth keeping in mind that this idea of Muslim terrorism, the majority of victims of Muslim terrorism are Muslims as well. So this isn't about Muslims being out to kill non-Muslims, but about also people who live in political situations that to reduce it simply to being about Islam is just far too simplistic. The politics, the culture, the history in a lot of these places, religion is often just a very convenient vehicle to mobilise force and actually has very little to do with what's going on.
This is the really final question. Brunei recently implemented the Budut in May. Do Muslims have a responsibility to uphold or favour Islamic law? So, or if not, do you favour a system of legal plurality to accommodate Islamic law in Australia?
I think in Australia there isn't really much of a push at all for people wanting to implement Sharia or anything like that. Like, it's just not on the radar for Muslims. The closest we have is, you know, we've just introduced Islamic superannuation. Finance, superannuation has just been launched and people are happy with that because they see it as more about ethical investments and those sort of things. But in terms about implementing Sharia and certainly implementing Hudud, no Muslims in Australia that I know of are calling for that at all. It's just not something that's important. Muslims are far more concerned with, you know, living as good citizens and what's going on overseas, but also this idea that the question implies that there is something lesser about being a Muslim living as a minority, that it's somehow a less legitimate Muslim experience. And that's simply not the case. We know from traditional classical Islamic law that Muslims living as minorities is a legitimate religious experience, and you don't have to be, when you're living as a minority, seeking to implement Sharia at every step of the way, that it is fine and permissible to live as a minority. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, lived as a minority, as a religious minority community for a long time, for many years. So it's okay to be living as a majority and a minority. And especially when you're living as a minority, different rules and conditions apply, and that's perfectly religiously legitimate.
Thank you very much, Susan, for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
I have been speaking to Susan Carlin from the School of Political and Social Inquiry from Monash University in Australia. We have been speaking about gender, religion and multiculturalism. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.